طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. Today, our Palestinian voices are those of two remarkable women who are part of the Palestinian 20% who live in what they call Palestine 48 and others call Israel. They speak about Palestinian resistance in 48 on an edited forum moderated by Tufts University professor Amal Bishara. It begins with Amal's introduction of Rula Nasser Mazawi and Aja Haj Oda.
Thank you so much to Cole Harrison, to Jeff Klein, to Ahmad Ahmed, and to everybody at Mass Peace Action for hosting us today and sponsoring this conversation. These last few months, as we know, we have seen another horrific upsurge in Israeli violence. And this is a time when we mourn those killed by bombs, bullets, and even mob violence in Gaza, the West Bank, and in areas under Israel's civil control. We try to fathom the toll today that arrests are taking on young people and their families in the Galilee, in the Naqab, in Jerusalem, and in the rest of the West Bank. We again witnessed, though through the attenuated ways of keeping in touch that we have with people in Gaza, how Palestinians in Gaza are beginning to plan rebuilding once again, rebuilding under siege, in imposed impoverishment, in the wake of so many years of trauma and in environmental ruin. So these are very difficult times, but we also must take this opportunity to mark how these last several months have seen an inspiring upsurge in action for Palestinian unity, as we witnessed on the day of the historic general strike on May 18th, and in the articulation of a manifesto of dignity and hope. I'll just quote from it very briefly. In these days, we write a new chapter, a chapter of a united intifada that seeks our one and only goal, reuniting Palestinian society in all of its different parts, reuniting our political will and our means of struggle to confront Zionism throughout Palestine, end quote. Now, we all know, many of us activists in the room know that moments like this do not emerge out of thin air, but come from months and years, decades of determined activism, of building relationships, of learning from each other, of getting on buses to stand and struggle shoulder to shoulder. Today, we will hear from two people at the heart of this work, based in Nazareth, in the territory that became Israel in 1948. So these are two people who are Palestinian activists who hold Israeli citizenship, often called 48 Palestinians. And they have played pivotal roles in supporting the movement against settler colonial evacuation and elimination in Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem. It is a true, true honor for me to be able to introduce them to many of you in the Boston community and beyond. And it's a true honor to be in conversation with them today. I will introduce them both and then turn it over to them. Rula Nasser Mazawi, who will be our first speaker, is a psychologist, social worker, and political activist from Nazareth. She is an advocate for Palestinian refugees and displaced persons and for the right of return. She is one of the founders and board members of Adar organization, which we'll hear more about today. And she's a board member of Badil Resource Center for Residency and Refugee Rights in Bethlehem, one of the premier Palestinian refugee rights organizations. Our second speaker is Aya Haj Oda, who graduated from Tel Aviv University in 2016 with a degree in law. And she has worked as a human rights lawyer with Adala, the legal center for Arab minority rights in Israel that does pioneering work documenting and challenging Israel's discriminatory and settler colonial framework and laws. and she now works with UNICEF on a human rights project to defend Palestinian children in Israeli military prisons. Recently, Aya started working in a human rights law firm as an advocate focusing on family reunifications within Palestinian communities. She represents prisoners on behalf of Physicians for Human Rights, and she is a founder of a Adad organization with Rola. So I'm going to turn it over first to Rola, and thank you again. Very big thanks to both of you for joining us today.
So good evening from Nazareth, Palestine. First of all, I'm very glad to be with you guys. I'm very excited to be the voice of my people to my people and to the world. I would like to share with you my great excitement and my pleasure that I carry with me since yesterday. Well, yesterday, our association, Adar, together with the Nazareth Palestinian Movement, Hirak, organized an event in the center of Nazareth, where we hosted the young fighters of Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan and Yafa in a panel that addressed the various forms of forced displacement that Israel does to Palestinians everywhere in Palestine. This is the new Nazareth. There were no events like this before. It was inspiring, just like every event that we organized lately has filled us with more energy. Well, seeing the wake of Nazareth, seeing the youth taking charge of spreading awareness on the policies that this colonial system is implementing everywhere is simply great. The feeling that we are getting back our identity, our unity, and will and power to challenge the Israeli colonial apartheid regime is so powerful. Since a lot of people don't really know about us, I'll begin by defining 48 Palestinians. 48 Palestinians today are around 1.6 million. We are the descendants of 15% of Palestinian people who managed to remain in Palestine after the Nakba, the creation of the State of Israel in 48. We have Israeli citizenship, but we are intentionally and formally marginalized and subjected to Israeli apartheid regime. 445,000 of us are internally displaced and prevented from returning to our homes of origin and denied reparations. I'll give you a very personal example. I'm originally from Bisan. My family was expelled from their home in Bisan in 1948, and since then we live in Nazareth. Bisan now is called Beit Shan and is for Israelis only. And that is just one side of apartheid Israel. Our biggest suffering here is being fragmented, separated and isolated from our people. After displacing more than 60% of our people outside the borders of historic Palestine, Israel detached us physically from our people who remained in the West Bank and Gaza by the apartheid wall, by Israeli closure regime of checkpoints and permit system, and by other psychological techniques. But for years, people here in 48 felt also detached from other Palestinians' perception as part of the Palestinian people. I'll talk a little bit about the life under the Israeli regime. It will be difficult to cover the wide range of Israeli discriminatory policies targeting us in Palestine 48. But let's take a quick look at some aspects of our daily life. Here, I'll address institutionalized discrimination that we suffer from on a daily basis. This kind of discrimination, designed especially in order to keep the privileges for Zionists and at the same time subjugate and marginalize 48 Palestinians so they will be always less Here, I'll address the institutionalized discrimination through two main examples. The first one is the Israeli discriminatory policy of zoning and planning, in which I will shed some light on land distribution, public services, and building and construction permit regime. The second one is the Israelization policy, aiming at elimination of the Palestinian national collective identity. I will focus here on the imposition of Israeli Zionist narrative values and symbols on Palestinians. So let's start with the Israeli discriminatory policy of zoning and planning that includes land confiscation, isolation, and confining of people, creating coercive environment causing forcible displacement. 48 Palestinians make around 20% of the population in Israel. But we are urged to live in very dense towns and villages that do not exceed 3% of the land. Now, since 1948, Israel destroyed 531 Palestinian villages. At the same time, there has not been even one village that was built for Palestinians since then. On top of that, as Palestinians, we are forbidden by law, from living in more than 960 Jewish-only residential communities. Now I'll give you an example of this land and building discrimination from my temporary hometown here in Nazareth. Nazareth's municipal area is 14 square kilometers for a population counting 80,000 Palestinians. Next to Nazareth, the Zionists established a settlement called nowadays Nof HaGalil, maybe part of you know it as the Nazareth Elite. Now it's called Nof HaGalil. On this settlement was built on the lands that was confiscated from both Palestinians who live in Nazareth, as well as Palestinians in nearby Ain Mahil. The area of Nof HaGalil is 30 square kilometers, designed for nearly 40,000 people. In Nazareth, Israel has not issued a permit for building industrial area, while Nof HaGalil, which was established recently, has 5 industrial areas. These areas provide the municipality of Nof HaGalil with huge income. At the same time, it causes pollution in Nazareth and surround areas like Al Mashhad, a fact that explains the increase in cancer rate among Palestinians in this area. In their towns and kibbutzes, Zionists' homes spread scarcely on wide areas. I have some pictures to show you after that. They have wide streets, lots of parking spots, parks for children and families. I remember one time I was driving my car and my children were with me. And we were passing through a settlement called Migdal HaEmek near Nazareth. And my daughter saw Doug's Park. She was shocked. And she asked me the most difficult question. Do they really mean that this is a dog park? Why do they have parks for dogs and we don't have even one park for us, the children? I'll continue to talk a little bit about Israelization policy and the targeting of the Palestinian identity, targeting the Palestinian consciousness. Well, Israel has aggressively targeted the Palestinian identity of 48 Palestinians, starting from spreading fear after the Nakba since 1948 up until today. This is a policy, the policy of spreading fear around Palestinians, crossing through the military rule that ended in 1966. People were terrified and found no way other than being silent to live. They found themselves obliged to be part of the system, to live, learn, work, move, travel, and be safe. They have chosen to go unnoticed, so they won't be targeted by a system considering them enemies and demographic threat by definition. They try simply to make us accept being less of a human and less of a Palestinian by depriving us from our national identity and identifying us as Israeli Arab. And nonetheless, by means of fragmentation into Muslims, Christians, Druze, and Bedouins, here comes to my mind the quote from Steve Biko, "The most potent weapon of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed." Well, this settler colonialism works through various channels. In school's curriculum, our children are obliged to learn Zionist values about the liberation of Israel, which is our Nakba, about Zionist Israeli heroes who killed and displaced our people in 1948, in 1967, and during First Intifada, and about their symbols. Nothing about our history or culture. To summarize this section, as for Israel, 48 Palestinians should accept being the weak part of this colonial system, should be kept away from their history and fundamental and national rights as Palestinians. They can ask for some civil rights here and there, but other than that, they will be denied. If they resist, they will be punished. If they struggle for their national human rights, they will be punished. Those who surrender their identity, dignity, and fundamental rights, they will be rewarded and flourish. So, what happened lately during the last uprising? I'll bring you three pictures just to try to make it easier for you guys to feel the vibe over here. These pictures from my hometown, Nazareth, but it reflects what happened in lots of towns and cities in Palestine 48. The first picture, hundreds of young Palestinians took to the streets with Palestinian flags, singing Motani, my home country, and chanting to Palestine. This took place every day for about 3 weeks. Now, despite the suppression of the Israeli police and soldier, these youngsters were so brave, they did not want to go back to their homes. The street was so beautiful, full of love and joy and optimism and challenge. Beneath all that, there was still a thin layer of fear, a fear that they implanted in our souls. But together, we felt so powerful and we were able to control it. Picture number two. A few days later, I passed through a neighborhood and I saw children playing demonstration. A young girl leading them while chanting, "Palestine is free from the river to the sea." Picture number three. Suddenly, out of nowhere, the walls of my town were filled with graffitis of the Palestinian flag, accompanied with the phrase, "We will not leave." These are three pictures. Nobody would have imagined that they will happen in Nazareth or any place in Palestine 48. For the first time, 48 Palestinians led demonstrations even in small villages like Iksal, Al-Mashhad, Tur'an, villages that have never had demonstrations in their history. and people were in constant confrontation with the Israeli forces united with our people in Sheikh Jarrah, in Silwan, and in Gaza. It was one movement that connected Lid to Sheikh Jarrah, to Nazareth, to Jaffa, and tens of towns and cities that stood strongly against the same suppression system. Suddenly, we understand that we are standing against the same suppression system. Settlers attacked Palestinians in the streets and in their homes almost everywhere, and they were protected all the time by the Israeli police and army forces. Two Palestinians at least were beaten to death, one in Lid and the other in Bat Yam. During these days and right after them, and up until today, Israel arrested more than 2,000 youngsters right from their homes in a very brutal way, and a clear show of power that aimed at scaring, terrifying people and punishing them for daring to show their commitment to Palestine. This campaign of arrests was designed for retaliation and oppressive purposes. They want to break and kill the will of resistance in the new generation. Until today, police forces are present in our villages, issuing arbitrary traffic violations as a way of punishing people in one hand and make us pay the price of the rockets that they launched on our people in Gaza. I was saying that during the past month, we drew graffitis for Palestine twice, and they sent their people twice to ruin it. They chased and interrogated the activists, and still the graffitis will be drawn again this coming weekend. Youngsters over here had declared that things have changed forever over here. The relationship with the Zionists is clear now. They are settler colonialists, and we are part of the Palestinian people. We are recovering our identity and regaining our dignity. We decided to challenge the Israeli apartheid regime and its policies, and we are ready, so ready, to pay the price for our freedom and rights. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Hula. It's so powerful to hear about this incredible time of activism and your voice to put it all in a context as well. And now we are very pleased to turn this over, the conversation over to Aya Hajouda.
First of all, thanks for having me. And I'm very glad to speak in front of all of you guys. I'll try to be short because of time. So I have Palestine 48. Rula had explained what is Palestinians 48, or how they also like to call us as Arab Israelis, or also Arabs, or I will call us here as Palestinians. What I mean by Palestinians, I mean the Palestinians of 48. So I will start with you, actually, with reality, the reality of the May of Rights. I will start by showing you a video, shows a brutal arrest of a 16-year-old girl at Bab al-Amud, which is the Damascus gate. Okay, I think it's enough. I'm sorry for showing this, and as you can see, more than 10 soldiers just had to arrest one child, 16-year-old child, in a very brutal way. I can say that it's very common. It's not something exceptional. It's not an arrest that we don't see every day. This is our everyday, it's the everyday arrests that we all face and see here in Palestine. And it's also the arrests and the way that Palestinians inside Israel are being arrested. So I will start by speaking about some of the conditions of how the Israeli law should or recommends to treat a child. Well, actually, You have, when you are a child, you can, and it's an obligation and it's mandatory by law, to have a presence of one of your parents. You have to get a medical treatment if needed, and the interrogation should be between, not during the night, which means between 7 till 10 during the evening. Well, if you are Palestinian, these conditions will not apply on you. And I will speak about a personal experience with this very child. I was at the station, at the police station, when the soldiers brought that girl. And that girl was handcuffed, and she was beaten in this brutal way that you saw. And her hands were bleeding because of the handcuffs. And she did not pose any threat to the security of anybody. I asked to loosen the handcuffs, but the soldiers and the interrogator refused to do so. And in the same time, and during the same event, there was another man who was drunk, who was also on drugs, who was really, he posed a threat on everybody there, including the interrogator, including the policeman, including everybody there. But lucky enough, he's a Jew, Israeli Jew, so he was free, he was not handcuffed, he was just going free there. And then this reality is the everyday reality, where the exceptional is the default when we are speaking about Palestinians. But the question is why? Why we are speaking about, when it comes to Palestinian, the default become the exception, and the exception become the default. Well, I will start by speaking about several laws that shows that Israel is racist country from its base and its core. I will start by the return law, the right of return, and I'm not speaking about the right of return for Palestinians. I'm speaking about the right of any Jew, which means any Jew in any country in the world who has any who doesn't have any connection or link to this land can come only based on his religion. If you are a Jew, you can come back. You can come here. And if you are Palestinian, and if you're a Palestinian who lived here during the 48, you cannot come back. If you own a land, if you own a house, you cannot come back here, because simply you are not a Jew. And simply, Israel is a very, very racist country. And the discrimination policies that the State of Israel uses I will be speaking about that in the next slides. I will continue regarding the absentee property law, which gives legitimacy of confiscation of Palestinian properties. The citizen law, which also gives Jews all over the world a citizenship based on their religion. The basic law that it's actually a new one. We're not speaking about a racist era from the Israeli history. Now we're speaking about an ongoing situation. The racist and discrimination that the racist policies and the discrimination institutional policies and systematic ones that Israel uses is ongoing, and it shows up here with the basic law that Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people, which gives Jews the right to self-determination in all over Palestine. So the Israeli laws are designed to discriminate Palestinians, and they target Palestinians, even though when we're not mentioning Palestinians in the law itself. What does that mean, and what do I mean by that? When the law says that you are a Jew and you can come back, we all know that Palestinians, or let's say the majority of Palestinians, are not Jews. So this doesn't apply on the Palestinians. When we are, the Israeli laws are written in a way that there are criteria that clearly Palestinians are not answering these criteria, that means that we are targeted by the law. I will be speaking now about the May Uprise arrests and the systematic discrimination policies that were used against us and the ill-treatment against Palestinians and also the excessive use of force against protesters. I will be showing now several pictures from all over Palestine 48, sorry, including Jerusalem. On the left, we can see a child. He's a child by law. He's less than 18 years old. And on the right, picture is another child. And one would wonder, why would a child, an arrested one, and surrounded by so many soldiers, being smiling? What is the question? And the thing here is that we Palestinians, we know the cause. We know why we are, yani, it's not an uprise that came without anything. It's an uprise that unites all Palestinians all over Palestine. And we know that when we are being arrested, we are just challenging. We are more, not just, we are more challenging the system and the systematic policies against us, and we are not defeated, and soldiers will not defeat us, and the army and the Israel and all these policies after 71 years. Yani, the fact that after 71 years we are all united, still united, and the child from Nazareth went to protest because of what's happening in Gaza or what's happening in Jerusalem and Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. It means that we are still united and we will remain, I think, united. Another arrests from Haifa, and what happened in Haifa, if we have time or maybe during the questions, I can speak more about what happened in Haifa and how settlers, armed settlers, went into Haifa and threatened the security of every Palestinian and marked the houses of Palestinians. But I think we don't have time for that. This is Emil Fahim, and this is also Palestinians who have the Israeli citizenship. This is Sheikh Jarrah. I will show you also, and it's very important to know that our struggle and our the protesters, we are also men, women, children, female children, and male children. Yani, everybody just went. Let's speak about arrests in numbers. There were over 2,010 detainees during this May Uprise. 275 indictments were submitted against. I guess, yani, it was 275 people. And the question is why? As Rula spoke about the fact that they want us to fear, to intimidate us. As yani, this is the intimidation policy. They want us to fear. They want us not to react. They want us to be quiet, to have a job, yani, to be the, as Rula described it very well, unseen, and in order to maintain the status quo and the unity of Palestinians, and there are way more reasons, but the intimidation policy is one of them. Let's continue speaking about the exception as a default when it comes to Palestinians. When you are Palestinian, it's easier to kill you. Let's see what's the Minister of Interior Security said about that. Well, the Minister of Internal Security tweeted, and it's very important for me to show you, the arrest of the shooter in Lid and his friends. That's what he tweeted during the 12th of May. The arrest of the shooter in Lid and his friends, which apparently was self-defense. When it comes to a Jew who kills, or Israeli, I don't like actually to call an Israeli a Jew, but here in order to make it easier, we will speak about, or I will actually call a Jew an Israeli because I'm more comfortable with that. He said that it is terrible. We are speaking about the arrest and not the fact that a Palestinian man was killed. The terrible thing was the arrest of the one who killed. Okay, let's continue. Even if there are things the public doesn't know, doesn't matter, but what he says that armed people are hands of the authorities. Freedom of speech. Well, I think everyone posts on Facebook, Twitter, and even this minister tweets every day, every night on Facebook. But when it comes to a Palestinian and a Palestinian leader, he would be arrested. And he would be arrested until the end of the procedures and only get his freedom back when we appeal to the court. So this is another example of how the exceptional became the default. And but very important thing to mention that the killer of Musa Hassouni is free. So we all now can understand more the systematic and institutionalized racist policies. So let's speak about now. What now? We have a new government, we have a new prime minister, and maybe we have a new hope. No, we don't, and we absolutely don't. Why? Because also on the same exact day, on the 12th of May, when this post, a tweet actually was published, the current prime minister.
And I think I will ask a question that two people asked from the chat. You mentioned the leadership. So people are asking, you know, what does it mean that there is a contradiction between, or, you know, can you think more about the contradiction between the rebellion and 48 among 48 Palestinians at the same time as a Palestinian party joins the governing coalition? Or to put it another way, what is the role, actual or potential, of Palestinian representatives in the Knesset? Is this a valid scene of struggle or a dead end for Palestinian politics?
Okay, so Rula, do you want to answer about this? Or I think Rula has so many things to say. If I have anything to add, I will. Rula?
Well, I think that the last uprising and the strike, they made it clear, and the aggression of the settlers and the of the police and the army made it clear for people over here that this is what made everything so clear. It made it clear that also the person who lives next to me in Nof HaGalil, he's a settler. He's not my neighbor. He's a settler. Okay, and it also made it clear that through the Knesset and through the laws that Israel puts for us, we will never be free, and we will never be there is no justice that will be done through the Knesset, because it is designed. It's a place that is designed. It's an entity that is designed to be discriminatory against us. And the only way to be free is to fight for this, and to be ready to pay prices for this. Now, we've been in the Knesset, 48 Palestinians, we've been in the Knesset for so long, like since 1949, we're there. And nothing happened. It's just getting worse for us. So it has no sense to be there. It's just legitimizing Israel and its policies and the laws that come out from the Knesset. Why? Because we are there. As long as we are in the Knesset, then we are legitimizing Israel and legitimizing all the laws, the discriminatory laws that they're issuing through the Knesset. And if we want to be free, we should be one with our people everywhere. This is a just cause that we should be very proud to fight for. We're fighting for our justice. We're fighting for our humanity, for being humane.
Thank you. Aya, did you want to add? Thank you.
I only want to add one point. It's going to be very short. I was speaking about the role of the Knesset in whitewashing Israel in the whole world, because the fact that there are less than 20% of Palestinians and the representatives of them are even less, that means that we would never, ever have any change from the Knesset. But it's not, this reason is there a reason in addition of what Rula said. We can't take it out of context. It's not only because we don't want to whitewash Israel's face in all over the world. It's in addition of all the policies that we don't think that it's legitimate for Israel to represent us, and we don't feel truly represented as a good tool in the Knesset. So whitewashing Israel's face on our backs, it's actually very funny when the same Knesset is the same Knesset that that also passes the very racist laws that they are passing for 73 years, and the ongoing passing of these laws.
Thank you. And let me ask
one thing, Amal. This is a colonial system. And a colonial system that wants us, like, we are the colonized and they are the colonizers, and they will always be they will always be better, they will always get more, and they will let us get as much as they want. And I don't want to live in such a place. I want to live in a just place. I want the return of refugees. This is our right, that our people come back to their homes and to their lands, and this will never happen through the Knesset. So the Knesset will always protect them and their rights. They get privileges through the Knesset. They get their privileges because we lose our privileges. I mean all the Palestinians, not just the 48 Palestinians. We want a just place. So we want to disassemble this colonial system. And it won't happen through the Knesset. So we find
absolutely. This is such an important message, as which we don't get, I think, in the U.S. media here, narratives of progress of including the Palestinian parties for the first time. So all of this is so very powerful. Can I ask Lynn Siegel? I'm going to ask you to unmute.
Well, it doesn't work as to be Israeli Palestinian. There is no Israeli Palestinian. We are Palestinians, and it's, for me, it's really sad that I have to say that I am 48 Palestinian. It's so sad for me. I am a Palestinian, and I have to identify myself like with a certain geographic area just because they fragmentized us and they took parts of Palestine, and it's sad for me. I want to be, my identity is Palestinian. That's it. And I say 48 Palestinian just to make it clear. So.
Exactly. I also want to remark this, what Rula just said. I feel 100% Palestinian, period, Palestinian. The Israeli part is only... the Israeli part of now, when Rula said 48, or Israeli, only to distinguish now for audience for American audience, who we are speaking about, because actually Israel had succeeded to divide us through the years in the terminology that it used. So I think we should start using only Palestinians for Palestinians, 48, 67, Gaza, refugees all over the world. We are only Palestinians. Yani, I feel Palestinian 100%, you know, and I am Palestinian. Using Israeli Palestinian, yani, I don't feel Israeli in any way. I'm not, and also the basic law, Israel is the state, the nation state of Jews. I'm not a Jew. Yani, it's that simple. And then our culture, our language, everything, yani, every cell of my body is Palestinian. So the terminology of Israeli-Palestinian is not accurate.
Thank you both so much. It's really powerful and important to hear your voices on this. I also feel certainly Palestinian and not Israeli in any way. And it is a challenge, I think, when we're speaking to outside audiences. Sometimes, I don't know how you feel about this, but because people don't always know what 48 Palestinians mean, I have been moving towards using Palestinians who hold Israeli passports or Israeli citizenship, because it sort of speaks to, first of all, it's long and cumbersome. So in some ways it speaks to the way in which that identity is a very difficult one to hold, but it, you know, it doesn't put a modifier in front of Palestinian, but it speaks to a certain category that may be useful at certain moments in speaking to American audiences about groups. I mean, it's a difficult issue, and really one that I think about very often as a writer. So we have some really great questions here in the chat. This is a hard one, a really hard one. How is it possible to struggle against Israeli planning and housing rules that discriminate against Palestinian citizens, like zoning for agricultural land around Palestinian towns that forbids housing? Of course, this also drives housing prices sky high. How is it possible to confront that reality, especially as you're talking about, you know, you're raising children or thinking about the next generation or just trying to survive?
Amal, can you repeat the question? Sorry.
How do people struggle against the Israeli planning and housing rules that discriminate against Palestinian citizens, like the zoning and agricultural land around Palestinian towns that forbids housing and also obviously drives up the cost of land? Like, I mean, in some ways you've been describing this, some of the activism, the grassroots activism and protests and so forth. I don't know if you want to talk about how to practically challenge these, you know, kind of as you're going about planning the next year of your life, for example. I don't know.
This is really hard, if I can start. Like, yeah, this is really hard. I show you the picture of Nazareth. It's sad to live here. It's inhumane to live here. There's no place. If I finish studying or working late, and I come back to my neighborhood, I won't find a place to park my car. And maybe the next day, one of the neighbors would get really angry about me or do something to me. And then, oh my God, Arabs are so aggressive. We're not aggressive. We live in an inhumane conditions. So this is really hard. And this is something that this is our daily life. How to confront this? When there are demolition decisions for a house here or there, we try to make people come there, hundreds, thousands, as many as we can. We don't always succeed to do that, and sometimes if there is a huge number of people, sometimes they delay it, but they delay it for 2 weeks, for a month, and then they come back and they demolish. This is very hard. We are standing against a system, a very powerful system, and They have weapons. They have everything. And when they demolish, they make the people pay for the demolition also. And paying for the demolition, it can be something around 500 to 600 thousand shekels, which is a lot. People don't have these amounts of money, and certainly like demolishing houses is a trauma for people. So here we are talking all the time about the facts, but in these houses, in these homes, families were raised and people have memories and it's their place. It's their only, this is very hard. I don't know how to stand and confront these demolitions. I think that all the world should be standing with us in order not to have any more home demolitions, not to have any more children or women or men left out, like without a place to be in. So how do we confront? I don't know how do we confront. We know that through the Knesset we can't do anything, nothing. It's not working. 73 years, it's just continuing. So I think the whole world that speaks about human rights should just open the eye and see what's going on. What's going on is a catastrophe for people. We're living in a very hard place. It's so hard to live in such places, so very dense.
Well, actually, now I was thinking, how would we really confront? Because you can't really confront, because we are subjected to all this brutal violence. It's yani, we can demonstrate, we can protest, we can do so many things, but the one who built the house, the one who built his hopes, his memories, he also is the same person who has to demolish it if it's not, yani, it's so inhuman that you ask someone to demolish his own house, yani, with the same hands that built it. Yani, or yani, there are two ways to demolish a house. They give you the order, go and demolish your house, and you, if we will demolish the house, you will pay for it. And so for so many Palestinians, yani, the connection with the house, we're not only speaking about a wall or a window. No, we are speaking about houses that contain families, memories. It's part of the policies that Israel had. Yani, one of the Israel's policies was to dehumanize us. Yani, you don't have any feelings. You will not feel any connection to your home or to your house. So how to stop it or how to confront it? Yani, we can't. No, yani, I'm actually. I don't know, Rula, if you think that... and also, Rula mentioned that maybe the...
You have been listening to Rula Nasser Mazwawi and Aja Haj Oda with Amal Bishara. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts wishing you a good morning. من مخيم إلى